So, hi Story Corps. This is Trip Harris here. I'm a sophomore at Gonzaga College High School. This is 2017. This is me interviewing my dad, Art Harris. So, when and where were you born?
I was born in Silver Spring, Maryland at Holy Cross Hospital in March of 1964 during a blizzard.
Very interesting. So, what was your life like growing up?
I had a great childhood. My family was very close. My dad was a very hardworking guy, but he always spent time with my sister and me. He coached all my football teams, baseball teams, basketball teams, all the sports stuff. We always had time to go out and shoot hoops or throw the ball. It was a lot of fun. We attended Mass on Sunday, and we just had a really neat childhood. I grew up in a court that had four kids that were my age, and then other kids, older siblings that were my sister's age. So we always had a group of kids around ready to play and have fun. And of course, we went to school together.
All right, so how did losing your dad at such a young age affect you?
I lost my dad when I was 13 years old, and it was very difficult. He was, as I said, he was very close to me. He was a really neat guy, and it was tough. He was sick with cancer and was sick for almost 2 years. It was a very tough battle, and the last several months were difficult, seeing such a strong, hearty man decline to the point where he had to be carried off of his bed to be able to use a bathroom or anything. It really took a toll on me as a young teenager. I was very lost and kind of went down a wrong path a little bit for a while, fell out in school, just didn't do the right thing. I never did anything seriously bad, but just was very angry and was, you know, just disenchanted with life and really couldn't understand why something like that had to happen. He was only 47 years old, and it really just wasn't fair. So I took it very hard. It took me a long time to recover from it.
Okay, so why did you decide to join the military?
Well, part of having lost my dad was in the Air Force when he was younger, and I thought the Air Force would be a great thing to do. I really wasn't doing well in school, and actually decided that school wasn't the place for me at that time. So I enlisted in the Air Force, and I did it because, as I said, I didn't really know what direction I wanted to go in. I was getting in a lot of trouble, and it was probably the safest place for me to go to kind of give me a direction. I needed to be pointed in a direction to figure out how I could continue my life and, you know, find a vocation that would be a good way for me to go. Good job. And so that's why I joined the military.
So when you went to that recruiter for the first time, you know, what was going through your head and what happened when you talked to him?
Well, it's funny because my mom had said to me, "What are you going to do with your life?" And I said, "I think I'm going to join the military." And she said, "Well, you need to go see the recruiter." So I did. I went down to the recruiting office, and I didn't finish up high school traditionally. I took a general equivalency exam and got my high school diploma. And when I saw the recruiter told me that he realized that I had that GED, and he said, "I'm sorry, you can't join the Air Force, but the Army will take you." And I said, "Well, sir, I don't want to join the Army. I really want to join the Air Force. My dad was in the Air Force, and I want to kind of go that same direction." And he said, "Well, you go to Montgomery College, you take one semester with a full load, and then no less than a C in any of your classes, and come back with your transcript." He said, "But nobody ever does it. You might be better off just going to the Army." And then at the end of that semester, I walked in on January 14th with my transcript, and I was in the Air Force on January 17th.
So when you joined the Air Force, was it hard for you to leave your family?
No. It was, my mom had remarried, and I my stepfather was a decent man, but I wasn't very close to him. And I was ready to get away from the area, try to get away from all the memories and trouble that I was getting in, and really, I was looking to find a new direction to go. And I didn't have a hard time. I was a little bit nervous because I didn't know what to expect, but I was ready.
Okay, so what was your experience like in the military?
It was completely different than what I anticipated. I thought I was going to get go into a vocation like learning how to work on computers or something, you know, maybe be an aircraft mechanic. And I ended up going into Air Force Security Forces, which is part of the Air Force law enforcement, military police, but also the Air Force ground combat, defending Air Force bases overseas and in the United States. So I became basically a combat soldier. I wasn't expecting that at all, and it was difficult. Very, very disciplined, a tremendous amount of physical training, difficult mental training, and learning how to use weapons and do all kinds of different things.
So what was the living and dining conditions like when you were in the military?
Well, the Air Force is different because the Air Force has a lot of great facilities. So I stayed in some really nice places until I started security forces. The food was good. You were so hungry, you would probably eat anything at that point. Once I started training with the security forces, our conditions sort of went down a little bit. We were in very, very old barracks that were almost falling apart. And then we spent a lot of time in the field, and we ate MREs or C rations, which if I had one now, I probably wouldn't like it. But that back then, they were great because I was so hungry. I really wanted to eat whatever they were going to give me. So it was fine. But I slept in fields and tents and all kinds of things. And when we were away from the field, our dormitories did have air conditioning, and it wasn't awful. So
when you were in the military, you obviously traveled to a bunch of different places. Do you have any cool experiences or any life lessons from that time?
I do have a lot of cool experiences. I went to several places. I was initially in San Antonio, Texas, and spent a lot of time training in San Antonio. Then I went to Minot, North Dakota, where I was a aircraft security specialist, and we provided the basic defense for nuclear aircraft and ensured their safety. And then I went from there to Keflavik, Iceland, where I was stationed for a year, and my job there was to deploy for different types of operations around through Norway, and we did some work in Russia.
Okay, can we get into any specifics maybe and a little story?
Well, I think I told you the story once of when I was in North Dakota. I was working on aircraft security. I was standing in front of I was on a security response team, and we had an alarm that we had a penetration. So what happens is there are ground sensors and fence sensors, and if the sensors go off in the same area, they call that a penetration alarm. That means that somebody stepped on the ground and touched the fence in the same area, and they consider that a threat. And where this was, there was no camera coverage, so we pulled up, and as I got there, there was a guy coming over through the Constantino wire with a toolbox, and he jumped down off of the fence and started running toward a nuclear-loaded B-52. So I jumped out of the truck and started chasing him. My partner went down the road. You couldn't drive on the grass. There were roads that sort of went around the area. So my partner had to go down the road to try to get ahead of him and cut him off. And as he came in front of him and cut him off, I was about 10 feet away from him, and I tackled him, and we had to secure the area. He was handcuffed and taken away, and then we weren't sure what was in the toolbox, so the bomb team had to come in. They actually had to move all of the nuclear aircraft out of the area to contain the threat. It was a very scary, probably about 5 or 6 hours before they realized that it was just a toolbox and he was just going in to tamper with the weapons.
So was he enlisted by anyone to go do this, or was he just like a psycho?
He was part of what they call the Red River Valley Peace Movement, which is actually a subgroup of Greenpeace, and they were anti-nuclear weapons, saying that you know, of course, the United States, we were warmongers. It was this is all during the Cold War back in the 1980s, and they linked them to this Red River Valley Peace Movement and further on to Greenpeace. And his organization had been involved in a lot of different acts on different military bases across the country.
Oh, so this wasn't... Was this... So this movement, this group, had been known for doing this quite often?
Yeah, they'd been... More than one occasion, they had gone after different military installations and tried to, you know, create problems.
Interesting. So how long did you stay in the military, and what did you do after you decided to leave?
So I was an active duty military for just under 4 years. And then I left active duty and went into the National Guard and came back. Well, After I was in Iceland, I received orders to come back to Andrews Air Force Base. And I was kind of disappointed with that because I was trying to get away from the Washington, D.C. area. But I was right back in Maryland. But I was supposed to stay in for 6 years. There was a... Back then, they had a thing called Graham Rudman. The military or the government came down with some spending cuts, and they decided that there were too many people that did what I did. So they moved me from active duty to the National Guard. So there I was in Washington, D.C., and I was in the National Guard, but it was only 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, and I needed to get a job. So I went to work, and I went to work as a police officer.
So when you came back, you said you did one semester at college, and I know since I'm your son, you went back to college. So what did you do when you went back to college, and what did you study?
Well, so one of the benefits of having been in the military is they offered the GI Bill, which was a great thing. It helped pay for my college. I decided that I wanted to pay for my own college, although my parents would have paid for it. I wanted to pay for my own college because I wanted to do it the way I wanted to do it. So I worked for DC for a while, and then I was I shot skeet competitively and got pretty good at it. And at one point, I won a pretty big skeet shooting tournament and was offered a job by the Beretta Firearms Company to work for them as a competitive shooter. And I ran their retail store during the week when we weren't having competitions. At that point, I was going to school full time while I was working, and decided to get a degree in criminal justice. And I was able to get a degree in industrial security management from the Community College of the Air Force. Got a two-year degree from Montgomery College, associate's degree in criminal justice, and then went to American University and got my bachelor's in justice, law, and society. So criminal justice and criminology, but they called it justice, law, and society.
So as police officer, like you stated before, also a very active job. Do you have any cool life lessons or stories from there?
Well, you know, I guess the working for Beretta was an interesting job. You know, in law enforcement, of course, there's always all kinds of stories. I have had, you know, several different situations, nothing really, really big. Most of the same things that most law enforcement officers do. But, you know, working for Beretta, I was able to travel around the United States shooting competitively. And I got to hunt in all kinds of different places all over the world on Beretta's ticket, which was nice. And shooting competitive was fun, but I ended up going to the World Skeet Shooting Competition where I ended up winning the 12-gauge East event. I shot a perfect 125 out of 125, which got me into the shoot-off. And that means that when you get there's several other people that shoot 125 out of 125, and we had to go and shoot off, and it was a miss and out. So you kept shooting until you missed. And the shoot-off went for almost 3 hours. And concentration levels were hard, but I kept grinding through. And for some reason, I knew that day I just wasn't going to miss. It didn't matter what I did, and I ended up winning. So it's kind of cool.
When you sit there for that 3 hours, are we talking like no breaks? Do you get a little drink of water somewhere? Are you guys straight going on for 3 hours?
Well, so you go 25 at a time, and you get a little bit of a break, not much. Okay. You have an opportunity to take a drink or whatever. But I think I shot 300 rounds in that shoot-off. It was pretty long.
That's pretty crazy. So, obviously, the time with Beretta ended. The time with the police department ended. What did you do when you left that?
And when I graduated college also, yeah. I decided Beretta had a really neat retail store in Old Town Alexandria. It was a sort of a clothing gift boutique with gift items, library, you know, nice old hardwood. Just a beautiful place, and they had their Beretta had their firearms on display there as well. And I thought it was a great idea, but it was very limited to Beretta products. And I thought if I did the same thing in Bethesda, which is very similar to Alexandria, with not being exclusive Beretta and throwing in fly fishing and a few other things, I opened up a retail store in Bethesda called the Gentleman Hunter. And the Gentleman Hunter was just a high-end hunting and fly fishing store. We sold a lot of clothing items, a lot of gift items, books, fly fishing, accessories for hunting. And then we had a vaulted room in the back of the store where we carried very high-end shotguns and rifles, just shotguns and rifles only, from the $3,000 to $75,000 mark.
So, did you have any famous people come into this store?
Yeah, we had a lot of famous customers. Tom Selleck, Ted Nugent was a customer. Several baseball players. Will Clark used to play for the he ended up playing for the Orioles. Football players. Have Dave Butts, who I still am friendly with. He played for the Washington Redskins. Shane Collins, another Washington Redskin. The Grease Man, the radio DJ, was a good customer and a good friend. It was a lot of different people came through.
That's pretty crazy. So you're back in Maryland now, and that's where we are still today. So how did you meet Mom? How did you meet your wife, which is the same person, Mom, wife? How did you meet them? How did that come about?
Well, I used to leave the store and go down the street to a place called J.B. Sims Tobacco, which was a cigar store. And there was a nice lounge there. And we would hang out in the lounge and smoke cigars. And, you know, I became really friendly with a couple of guys that were there. One especially was a guy named Mike Copperman. And Mike eventually ended up buying the store and changing the name to Bethesda Tobacco. But Mike and I had done a lot of stuff together. We, you know, got to know him a little bit better. He had an older sister. And one day, it was probably like December, he said, I got this gal that I'd really like you to meet. I think you'll really like her. You know, my sister and I think you guys would do really well. She was our next door neighbor growing up. There's a New Year's party and, you know, I think you should go. And I said, well, I don't know. I had just gotten out of a relationship and I didn't really want to meet somebody. And I said, Mike, I don't know. I'm not really interested in that right now, but tell me a little bit more. So he told me more about her, and the more he told me about her, she, you know, it got more interesting, and I got a little bit more interested in meeting her. But that took a little while. It was about a 3-month period, but I kept remembering saying, so what else, Mike? What else do you know? You know, what does she do for a living? And so after that 3-month period, I pretty much felt like I knew her, even though I hadn't met her, and I was sitting in Bethesda Tobacco. We were upstairs in the lounge, and somebody yelled from downstairs, Michael, and it was a lady's voice, and Mike says, oh my gosh, he goes, that's her, she's downstairs. So of course I got very nervous, and I said, okay, and he goes, let's go meet her. And I'm like, oh my goodness. So we walked downstairs, and she was in there with a friend, and we were introduced, and it was love at first sight. One of those things, I knew right there that she was the person I wanted to be with, and we had some little banter there that went well, and I think she liked me too, maybe not as much as I liked her initially, but you know, it was history from there on. We met, it was February, and we ended up getting married in October.
How did you propose to Mom?
when we first started dating, we ate Chinese food, and your mom got a fortune in her fortune cookie that said, in a valley by a stream, you'll realize your life's long dream. And I kind of put that in the corner of my mind thinking, wow, that's a really, really kind of neat thing. Maybe that can make that work somehow. So when it came time for me to propose, I found a place that was basically a valley with a stream in the middle of it, down by an old mill, somewhere sort of out in Gaithers, Germantown area. And I had a friend who owned a restaurant cater a meal out on a table right by the stream. And I told him, we'd set up what time we'd be there. And I found a violinist who would come out from behind the mill and play the violin for us. So, and I put 13 red roses on the table, which is an informal proposal. And I told your mom that we needed to go look at something up in Germantown. I had to go pick something up for a customer. And so we were driving out there, and she was kind of irritated, like, I don't have time to do this right now. And I said, well, we need to go out here. It's really important. It's a good customer. So we drove up, and I pulled into the parking lot where the mill was, and she saw the table with the flowers, and she was like, what's going on? And so we walked out to the table, and she looked at the flowers, and you know, I said I wrote on the card, "In a valley by a stream, you'll realize your life's long dream." And she sort of looked at me, and the violinist started playing as he came around the corner. So I got down on one knee and proposed, and a whole bunch of people that were driving by were like, "Woo!" They cheered. It was great. It was pretty.
It was a little cool.
Yeah, a little romantic.
Yeah. So, if correct me if I'm wrong, but does your mom still have that original fortune cookie?
And the original card that was on the flowers. Mom still has them, yeah. They're in her wallet.
That's pretty cool. So, when you guys got married, how did that change your life? How did that change things with the business, with everything?
Well, you know, it didn't change things with the business that much at first. Things changed for me. I was born and raised Episcopalian. And you know, mom was Catholic, so I started spending more time in the Catholic Church, and started exploring. You know, Episcopal is very close to being Catholic. They call it Catholic light, but I started exploring more and more about the Church. And when we got married, the priest that married us was a Catholic priest and a wonderful man named Father Bryce. He told me that if I ever decided I wanted to become Catholic, that I needed to come see him. And so, you know, some time passed, and mom became pregnant with you. And I said, you know what? I think our family should grow up Catholic. We should be together Catholic, so I'd like to become Catholic. Mm-hmm. So we called Father Bryce, and Father Bryce invited us to come down, and mom actually sat through all the classes, and Father Bryce brought me into the Catholic Church after being with him one-on-one or two-on-one every Monday for like a year. And then I went through my confirmation and my first reconciliation, and became the Catholic in I guess it was April that year, Easter time. And that was an incredible thing, because it got me very involved in church. It was a big turnaround for me. It was at that point in my life where I was finally able to reconcile being hurt about my dad. I was very angry at God for taking him away from me, and going through that experience and having the first Holy Communion and being able to confess that I was angry at God for taking my dad away was really like a cleansing thing. So it was a great thing that happened, and you know, from there we went to being involved quite a bit in the church. And I was on the parish council, and I actually became the parish council chairman at one point. And it was really nice. But before all that, you were born, and life changed quite a bit. Mom was a big time executive at MCI and Verizon. She was a VP, and she was making a lot of money and was working a lot. And we, first couple of years you were born, first 5 years you were born, we had a nanny that was taking care of you.
Rosa.
Rosa.
Yeah.
It was a nice lady. She was definitely very good to you. And, you know, mom continued to work. I continued to run the store. And then one day, I guess you were getting ready to go into kindergarten. You decided, you asked mom to stay home. You said, "Can you stay home? I don't want you to go to work anymore." And mom did. And she was able to get a nice compensation package, and she decided to stay home. At the same time, you know, our lives were changing so much. I had the opportunity to sell my business, and I made a deal with Bass Pro Shops to open up my business basically inside their business. So we were opening up the Gentleman Hunter Gun Room at Bass Pro Shops, and we started off with one, ended up with seven, and I consulted with them for a long time, helping them out, doing merchandising, you know, opening up the new stores, and it was really pretty neat. It was really pretty neat. It was a great opportunity. So I left the full-time retail business and ended up becoming a consultant.
So when I was born September 10th, 2001, one day before 9/11. So what was that like? Because the world was in chaos right there. You guys were in D.C. So
yeah, so you were born at Sibley Hospital in 10 o'clock at night on December 10th or September 10th, just before the 9/11 incident with the planes crashing into the buildings. And it was you know, the night was weird. Really didn't get much sleep, but we did fall asleep briefly, and we woke up to the second plane going into the World Trade Center, and immediately, mom, one of her customers was a Federal Aviation Administration, and mom went to pick up the phone to say, "Hey, I need to find out what happened with my network failed." And I said, "No, babe, I don't think so. I think you need to worry about what we got going on here." So we had your little guy, you, and all of the, it seemed like the world was falling apart, but at the same time, we had the greatest joy of our lives having you. So we were kind of torn, and everybody that walked into the room was looking at the TV, and so we finally had to turn it off because we said, "Hey, you got to pay attention to this little guy here. He needs some help." And so does his mom. She just had a baby. So it was weird because a lot of the overflow from the Pentagon started coming into Sibley. A lot of the place, they couldn't take all the people in the other hospitals in D.C., so they ended up bringing them to Sibley Hospital where we were. So we kept seeing ambulances pull in, and then as the day progressed, your grandparents came in, and they hung out with us. Your mom's mom and dad. My mom was in Georgia at that point. And all of your mom's employees, the people that worked for her, coworkers and stuff, just didn't really have any place to go because they were, you know, nobody was working. They came over to the hospital to see the baby. I think everybody was trying to look for some positive in a really, really scary, negative world. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty amazing. You came out, as you do now, made happiness out of a sad situation, which is good. It was a neat memory of your birth.
Appreciate that. And a little follow-up question. Is it true that I looked like an alien?
Yes, you did. When you were born, you looked like an alien. But nobody ever tells dads that before babies are born. It's one of those things you have to learn. You did. You had a pointy head, and at first I didn't know what it was. It scared me. But you got normal, so it was good.
Thanks.
And, you know, life changes when you have a kid. You became the center of our focus, especially because you're an only child. And, you know, I personally, because having lost my dad at such a young age, wanted to make sure that you never had to think of, if something ever happened to me, I wanted you to think that I was always there and there to take care of you and teach you and do whatever. So I got very involved in your sporting events and your school, and almost like having a full-time job. And so did mom. She did everything at DeShonnell. She was charged with the Home and School Association, and we were both Eucharistic ministers. I was on the parish council. She was on the finance council. So it was a really, really busy time. A lot of things going on. And, you know, it changed our lives for the better, for sure. It changes every day. The new things at Gonzaga, of course. You're at Gonzaga High School now in D.C., which is a wonderful Jesuit boys' school. And never thought I'd spend so much time going back to D.C. after having left being a police officer there. I swore I'd never go back, but it seems like I'm there quite a bit, but I still really enjoy it.
So, being around 54 years, being a bit of an older guy.
Not quite 54.
What are you proudest of, and why are you proud of that?
My greatest accomplishment is my son.
Flattered. Thank you.
Because you're a good kid, and you're a smart kid, and you have a lot going for you. I am extremely proud of my wife, because I think she's the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm proud of my service to the military. I think that everybody, if they have the opportunity, should do it. It's an incredible ride. It's definitely worth it. It taught me a lot of things about life that I probably would not have known. And I saw a lot of things I might not have ever seen, some good and some bad. But you know, it was definitely worthwhile. Life is a great thing.
So if you had to choose one person who's had the most influence on your life, who would that be?
The one person that's had the most influence on my life. I could probably say there's several. I probably couldn't just say one particular person. You know, mom would be probably number one. I always gravitated toward my friends. My friends were older than me most of the time. Most of my friends were, you know, 8 to 10 years older than me. Probably because I was looking more for a father figure. I mean, I have friends that are my age too, of course, but I have another good friend, Phil Capinelli, who has been a buddy of mine since 1979, and he is 12 years older than me, I think. 13 years older than me. Mm-hmm. Very wise guy, seen a lot of things in his life. And it was always one of those guys you could ask for advice, and he would, he'd be right there. He'd be able to, you know, tell you, man, look, you're going around the wrong path. And he was very black and white. He was never, there was never any gray area. He would say, Artie, big Italian guy, Artie, no, it's not working. You need to fix that. You know, you need to straighten yourself out there. And, so yeah, that's. Those, you know, those kind of people influenced me. You know, my father obviously influenced me tremendously. In 13 years, I had more with my dad than most people have in a lifetime. He was always very, very hands-on. He always took the time. And he treated me like an adult, sort of. He would, instead of, you know, reprimanding me, belittling me if I did something wrong, he would actually say, think about what you just did, you know, think about the consequences of what you just did, and think about how it causes other people to react around you. So did you really mean to say that? Is that what you really meant to say? And you know, things like that were, and it was definitely a big influence.
So how would you like to be remembered?
How would I like to be remembered?
I need a few little curveballs right here.
Yeah, exactly. I would hope that my grandfather used to say, I wish people would say I was a good man. And that's probably enough. You know, I would wish that somebody would say, that Art Harris, man, he was a good man. He was a good man. He always...
Was a geek.
Never did anything wrong to anybody. He never treated anybody poorly. That's what I would... And a good father and a good husband.
Certainly on that track right now, and you're
thanks.
Doing it. So, say this is our last conversation we're ever going to have. What would you want to say to me?
Oh, Lord, I don't even want to think about that. You know, the only thing I would really want to do is make sure you were true to yourself. Make sure you look at the big picture, look ahead at what's going to happen, because, you know, the things that I did, although they worked out okay, my life could have been a whole lot easier if I didn't go in that direction that I did. Not that I regret it at all, but there are opportunities out there. But, you know, life is what happens. And I say sometimes if things were different, I might not have met Mom and you might not be here. So, but you got to be true to yourself. You got to be nice to everybody. You got to help people. And you got to do your best. Doing your best is the most important thing. Much more important than not getting the job completely done.
True. All right, so if there was anything, is there anything in your life that you would want to change, maybe switch it up a little?
You know, I was a good football player when I was in high school. I was fast, and I was a big guy, and I was strong. I was, you know, I used to always be into lifting weights and stuff like that. I wouldn't go back. I wouldn't really want to change anything. I would like to know how far my football career would have taken me, because I had opportunities to play in college. I had colleges that actually sent me letters of intent to play Division I football. But I decided that enlisting in the military was the smartest thing, and it was. Who knows if I had to play football, what would have happened, but I'd like to know that I was able to at least start in college and maybe have an opportunity to go further than that.
So can you tell me anything else about your life, your military time, maybe a little story from there?
Well, most of the stories that I could tell you about the military, I can't really tell you.
Classified?
Because of some certain things, yeah. Scariest moment, one of the scariest things in my life is I had to get to Panama in 1989 during Operation Just Cause when they were taking out Manuel Noriega. We went to support Air Force Special Operations Command secure bases and things like that. that was a interesting time in the military. It's kind of, we were still in the Cold War and we still hadn't, you know, this violence in the Middle East wasn't there. or at least it wasn't really there. It was just starting to become a problem. So I didn't have to deal with that. I got out actually 7 days before my unit had what they call a stop loss before the first desert storm when they went to Saudi Arabia and Iraq to try to, or Iran, or excuse me, Iraq to try to keep Saddam Hussein. They chased him back into his country, and he was trying to take over Kuwait. So I didn't end up going with my buddies for that. I sort of regret that. I not that I wanted to go to fight. I just didn't want to leave my buddies alone. I remember telling them that I wanted to, I wanted to reenlist at that point. I wanted to reenlist because my actual time in the National Guard was up at that point. And I wanted to reenlist because I felt like I should be with them. I shouldn't leave them to go into war without having me there. It wasn't right. And they talked me out of it. They said, look, you were planning on getting out. There's no reason to stay in. But I sort of wish I had, just because of that. And I also wish I had finished up 20 years in the military, because health insurance is very expensive. And I wouldn't be paying for it right now if it wasn't for that. And I'll tell you, you think it's a long time down the road, but when you look back, it was just minutes. Mm-hmm. Those years seemed like minutes back then. Those years seemed like decades. That is probably my biggest regret. That's the only thing I would really, really like to change is having retired from the military. That would have been a smart move.
Since we've been taking a look backwards, let's take a little bit of a look forwards into the present. What do you think the best part of life is right now?
Well, the best part of life right now is family, doing stuff together, doing stuff with you and mom. You know, we go on trips like running up to New York City for the day or whatever. Those things are fun. And, mom and I get to go to lunch just about every day, and that's one of my favorite things. But I also really enjoy hanging out with you, doing stuff like taking you hunting. That is a great thing with me. And sort of sharing my hobbies with you, mm-hmm. I like to, as you know, of course, I like to hunt and fish. and I like to shoot at clay targets. Used to be really good at it, and I don't shoot as much anymore, so I'm not as good as I used to be. And I like classic cars. I like going to car shows. I like showing you what all the old cars used to look like back in the day. You know that not all cool cars are Lamborghinis. Some of them are some of them are old, and I like classic rock, and I like to kind of hang out with you and listen to classic rock when in the car instead of listening to modern music. It's more my thing, and mm-hmm. I think you like it. I do like it. I think you enjoy some of that music.
Yeah.
I like getting outside, doing stuff. Just having fun, not always about working on schoolwork or everything else that you've got going on, or working all the time. It's nice just to get out and enjoy life.
Yeah. So we're recording this for future generations, so we'll have this later. You never know who could be listening to this. So maybe my son will be listening to it. Your grandson. Great-grandson, my kids, you never what's going on here. So is there anything you would like to let him know, leave with them, a little inkling of wisdom?
It's funny you say that, because you made me think about, I have some tapes of my dad when he was speaking. I wish that you had met him. I wish he had met you. I think my dad would have fought me about trying to coach teams. He'd be the one who was trying to coach the team. He'd say, no, I can do this. You sit back and watch. but I definitely want your kids to know how much you were loved and how much I was loved by my mom and dad. My mom was a great lady too. We didn't really talk about her that much, but she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. and you had the opportunities you had in life, and I really just want to see your kids and my mm-hmm. which would be my grandkids, and really look forward to the future and what the future has for us.
All right, so this has been Trip Harris on November 25th, 2017. I'm 16 years old. My dad, who's 53, was the So we're an interviewee.
Interviewer.
Yeah, well, I was the interviewer. This was a great conversation. It was very interesting to listen to. So I guess we're going to sign it out here. Have a good one.